Welcome to Cooking Issues on the Heritage Radio Network. I'm Dave Arnold, the host of Cooking Issues, here with Nastasha the Hammer Lopez, the person who keeps the wheels on the truck. Call in all of your questions, cooking-related or not. Well, probably cooking-related, technology-related or not. Although we will take all questions.
We'll take all issues.
Yeah, right. Today's show isn't just cooking issues. It's issues in general, especially coming off the holiday weekend. Call in all your questions, too. 718-497-2128. That's 718-497-2128. We're going to be here live for another 45 minutes or so. Today's show is brought to you by 360 Cookware. 360 Cookware is top-of-the-line stainless steel cookware that is made in America in the greenest cookware manufacturing facility in the country. It can be used to make all of your favorite recipes, but it also gives the option to cook using vapor technology, which creates a seal that surrounds food with intense heat, locking in vitamins, moisture, and flavor without added oil, fat, or excess water. Visit our website at 360cookware.com for more information. That's 360cookware.com. Okay, now, all right, so while we're waiting for that phone call, let's start in on the Thanksgiving and the heritage turkey, the Narragansett. Any of you listened last week? We received a heritage breed Narragansett turkey from Heritage Foods, and I cooked it using a technique. We have a caller, so I'll go back into it in a minute. But suffice it to say, best damn turkey I've ever made in my whole life. So good, in fact, so good that. No one was able to take a picture of it before it was completely gone. I swear to God, like, I've never not had turkey leftovers the next day. We didn't even have that many people. Turkey was obliterated. Obliterated. Gone. Anyway, okay, so we have a caller?
Mm-hmm.
Caller, you were on the air. Hello? Oh, we lost our caller.
Hello?
Hello, hey, how you doing?
I'm doing fine. I'm calling from California, and I actually have a question about your hydrocolloid course coming up in January.
All righty.
I'm trying to decide whether it's worth $1,500 for the course plus the flight across country and three nights in a hotel room.
Right. Well, so hopefully you'll also eat at some good restaurants while you're here. One of the benefits of being in New York.
Just saying. I do that every year, yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So you're asking me to sell the class. Okay.
Exactly.
All right. Well, here's what I... Hydrocolloids, first of all, and I'm a little bit biased because I teach the class, along with Nils Noren, the VP of Culinary... Culinary Arts, I guess, is his title over there. It's, I realize that the classes can be somewhat pricey, but there's a whole lot of work that goes into it. And whether or not it's worthwhile for you depends a lot on you. Hydrocolloids is it's a difficult subject to teach because invariably in the class we get people with a wide range of previous knowledge, previous experience, and also goals, right? So when you're teaching something like low temperature sous vide cooking, pretty much everyone's goals are fairly similar, and it's a matter of just showing people what's possible within the realm, within the context of cooking low temperature. You know, this is what we can do with different kinds of proteins at different times with different treatments. This is what we can do with vegetables and various technologies, ways to do things. And so, like, it's very focused, and everyone is there pretty much with the same goal in mind. Hydrocolloids is such a wide open field that we have to hit, there's certain things we have to hit, right? Because some people in the class may have never used hydrocolloids at all, and some people might be very, very experienced. So the class has to be a balance between things that, maybe you might already know how to do, like spherification. We tend to deal with it with a more, in a more kind of rigorous way than you would get anywhere else. I think that's, the goal, that's what, we try to do in general at the FCI and the tech department and cooking issues in particular. We try to do things in a very rigorous way whenever possible. And I think that's a standpoint you can, you always get. But aside from those kind of basic techniques, we also try to teach some techniques. There's always something that no one's seen before because we always try to develop at least one or two new things for each class. I mean, when I say new, I mean like brand new. And then, the other thing besides the specific applications is we try to teach a particular way of thinking about using these ingredients. So, how to develop a recipe properly. So, I mean, I think that I've had people take the class and come back to me and said that, they were able to apply their stuff right away in their menus. You know what I mean? I've never had anyone come back and say, it was useless, or like what wasn't necessarily worth it. I think it all depends on what you want to get out of it and kind of how you want to apply it. I mean, a lot of the people that we deal with are chefs, and so for them, it's straight up. I mean, I don't know whether you're a chef or not, but a lot of them is straight up. Well, am I going to get enough new menu items out of it? And usually, the answer is yes. you know, also I'm terrible at selling myself. Am I right, Nastasia?
That's true.
I'm like the worst person at selling myself because, I hate to sell someone on something and then have them not get what they want. Is this helpful at all or no?
It's a little bit helpful. Let me tell you where I'm at. I've read things like the hydrocolloid recipe collection from Martin Lersch, and I've read your primer and stuff and done some of the recipes. I'm not as interested actually in recipes as I am in understanding if I'm going to be using, sodium alginate and calcium carbonate, that what are the, how does acidity affect it? How does, temperature affected, things like that, so that I can then use those chemicals on my own without a recipe to develop new things.
I mean, that's our goal. My goal in general, and if you talk to, like my brother-in-law, Wiley Dufresne at WD-50, he prefers not to just give out straight recipes because he wants to foster understanding of how to use these ingredients, right?
Right.
The one problem is that it's over the course of 2 days we're going to be dealing with a wide range of products. So for instance, with alginate, one of the things we deal with in general, alginate, as you've alluded to, for all those of you who don't know what the heck we're talking about, sodium alginate is a seaweed derived hydrocolloid, like a gelling agent that stays liquid until it hits calcium, free calcium, at which point it forms a gel that that is not broken neither by heat nor by anything else. Basically, it's just the gel's there forever. The unfortunate part about sodium alginate is it tends to suck up flavor, have very kind of poor flavor. The gel itself, you would never eat a block of alginate because it just tastes wretched. Anyway, but so as you know, it's affected by acid. So yes, we get into that, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's more saying the level we're going to take it to is, look, you can't have acid, too much acid, because it's going to cause the alginate not to set. And then, furthermore, you need to use something called a sequestrant to sequester the calcium that's freed up in the water as the acidity increases, or use a buffering agent such as sodium citrate. We'll get into that kind of stuff, and like sodium hexametaphosphate, but there's only a certain level of actual technical information we can get into in the class because, we're dealing with people with a wide range of backgrounds and goals. You know what I mean? So we're going to deal with it, but I'm not going to say that it's the same as reading scientific literature on the subject, which we can point you to. You know what I mean?
The scientific literature doesn't necessarily apply. I find a lot of it is just to get to the where I can use it in my cooking is a bit obtuse.
Right.
I'm a culinary instructor, and I really don't like giving out recipes. I'm in that frame of mind. I want to teach people principles. I want to teach them how to think about the food and then go ahead and do it without having to follow a recipe line by line, some sort of prescription. So that's the sort of, and it sounds like you're doing that in the class, so you're not doing recipes, that you are going more into the principles.
Right, and we've had really good luck with culinary instructors, by the way, taking our class, so to get the school to pay for it. Anyway,
it's a non-profit, sorry.
Oh, yeah, all right. Well, anyway, I hope to see you in January, and thanks for calling.
Okay, bye.
All right. Back to our Thanksgiving real quick. Wait, we have another caller? Caller, you are on the air.
Hi there, Dave. Hi. It's Colin Gore again from down here in D.C.
Howdy.
I have two things I want to ask. I know there's probably a break coming up, so maybe pick whichever's easier.
We'll power through it. Let's do
first. All right, okay. So first thing I want to do, I'm making oyster mushroom soup oysters, right, out of kind of dropping them in an alginate bath and making these kind of like snotty little oyster-looking things that are full of delicious, briny oyster soup. And I want to make the kind of that alginate skin on them a little more pearlescent, a little more like, oystery, not like thin, translucent kind of snotty thing you get from the alginate.
Right. Okay. So, but like hard snot. It's not like a xanthan snot. You're not adding a lot of xanthan.
Oh yeah.
To
no.
It.
No. They come out great. It's just they're clear, right?
Right.
And I want that very surface kind of skin to have a little bit of be more translucent than transparent.
Okay.
Give it some.
Here's a kind of color. Okay. Here's a couple of ways we can go. First of all, are you doing a forward alginate or reverse alginate?
Reverse.
Okay, they're frozen beforehand or not frozen?
Not frozen.
Okay, just out of curiosity, I do a lot of mine. I'll freeze just because it makes it easier. Like you freeze the mixture and then you drop it in. You don't have to worry
about
it.
Yeah, that's a good idea.
Okay. Yeah. So I
definitely had problems with, forming them been hit or miss.
Yeah, basically, yeah, 98% of the time I'll pre-freeze them because it's not that long of an extra step, and it just makes your processing much easier. Okay, now to your pearlescent problem. There are a couple of solutions. So you're looking to add something to the alginate bath, both to modify the texture and the look. Okay, now, if you want to just modify the look, I don't recommend this, by the way. What I'm saying to you, I don't recommend, but you can go the Kike da Costa method. Kike da Costa, as you might know, famous Spanish chef, adds a lot of metal dust to a lot of his stuff, right? So you can get food-grade, basically pearlescent powder that's relatively flavorful. I'm not recommending this, but I'm saying, like, as the fastest way.
Right, right.
So he did a famous dish where he did an oyster that he literally put silver dust on, like an oyster, not like what you're saying, I believe. It's been a long time, been many years. But that looked, you know, that was some shiny stuff, you know what I mean? And it gave an interesting look. I'm not so much about adding stuff that doesn't have a sort of a flavor impact. Now, if you want to go flavor impact, you can do that. It's going to look good. It's not going to affect the taste. So you can get food-grade silver either from, like, usually leaf if you get it from an Indian source, like an Ayurvedic source, or you can get food-grade powders. I don't know where Kike got them, probably somewhere in Spain. Now, if you want to add more of a shimmer to it, and you want to modify the texture of the alginate, right, so that it doesn't taste like solidified snot, right? Technical term, right, Nastasia? Yes. Solidified snot? Anyway.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So what I would do is emulsify some oil into the alginate base before you drop. So what you're doing is so that's going to – this is an old semi-established technique, but one that's not really talked about a lot, because everyone knows that the texture of an alginate gel is not so great. If you add a little oil, emulsify a little oil in to it, right, all of a sudden now your teeth are going to break it better. It's going to look better. It's going to feel softer, and as long as you're careful with it, you're not going to destroy the integrity of it too much, right?
And
to me, much more than adding metal dust to it, like that, because you're improving the actual product other than just the visuals. It will also, you know, because you're emulsifying stuff in, it'll get a shimmery, you know, more of a salad dressing-y shimmery look to it, but you're actually also going to be making a better product. Just make sure that you're emulsifying oil into the alginate and not the other way around, because the alginate needs to be the continuous phase.
Okay.
Yeah. Anyway. And what was the other one? Yeah. Let's see if we can tackle the other one real quick before I go to break, although Nastasia and Jack are going to chop my head off.
Yeah, I want to ask if you ever – so your juices that you clarified with your Pectinex, you got, you know, nice clear juices. Have you ever tried reducing them or making a glaze or even like a caramel out of that reduced juice?
Oh,
like,
yes.
Do you know if the Pectinex has a negative effect on that at all?
No, we do that all the time. I mean, I've never done it over heat because, like, you know, we're all about trying to preserve the original flavor of it. So I typically will reduce in my rotary evaporator. But I've made some of the most ridiculous reductions. So, like, typical applications we've done, like fresh apple reduction that we've clarified and taken it down to a syrup. We've done fresh strawberry. In fact, I don't know whether I talked about it on air, but it was a result of a question someone asked on air once. I made a candy where we did I reduced the fresh clarified strawberry juice down, you know, without heat, down to about 33 bricks, and then stirred that into a candy base that I had made that I'd let cool, you know, somewhat so that the strawberry wasn't flavored. Crazy, crazy good, crazy good. And we've done blood orange. You like the blood orange, right, Nastasia?
Yeah, really good.
Where we reduce it to a syrup post clarification. So it's an excellent application. I don't know what the results with heat are because it's going to taste a little bit cooked. But you know, so there's certain clarification steps that if you can cook it, you might as well cook it. But on the other hand, Pectinex is very good, especially on things like apple and whatnot. So yes, the answer is yes.
So I was just curious then. What if if I wanted to kind of take the remaining starchy bits and the solid bits out of some, like, a sweet potato slurry and try to caramelize the remaining sugars left over. I know you even talked last week about, this is something I've been thinking about for a while. Because you know how, like, when you bake a sweet potato, you get this delicious, sometimes you get this delicious, like, caramely stuff that oozes out.
Yes.
And, like, drips on the pan. And I want to make that, but, like, in large amounts. So I figured, especially when I had saw a paper a couple months ago about, you know, there being a lot of amylases in sweet potatoes, so you could maximize, you know, how much sugar's in them, maybe break down some extra starches, and then I got to figure out a way to kind of turn that into, like, you know, remove enough of the kind of solid matter to get, like, a sugary liquid I can simmer down and turn into a caramel.
There's no question in my mind at all that you can juice a sweet potato and then clarify it. No question. And then the sugars will be in there. Now, if you wanted to get sweeter, you could add some brewers, some amylase to it. You know what I mean? Some alpha beta amylase. You could get a brewer supply shop, add it to that, and just basically mash it out like you would a wort for a beer. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And then the question is getting the right balance, then clarifying it and cooking out the mash before you set the starch. So the key is that to spin out or to clarify out the extra starch before you gelatinize it. You know what I mean? Because then after you gelatinize it, everything's
so
a pain in the ass.
Would you think Tekkenex would be a good wrap for that? Or
I don't know. I could try it.
Physical separation would be easy enough?
I mean, physical separation is what I would try first, but I mean, because I don't know how much of it's soluble. I don't know how much of it is stabilized by the pectin, but it's something we could try. If Nastasha remembers to write it down, we'll give it a whirl. But yeah, definitely doable. But now,
could I just try throwing, like if I tried throwing it through a juicer, for instance, afterwards, would that be possible? Because I would juice it right away,
and then do any procedure you're going to have to the juice, because it's just going to free up more of the enzymes. So do all your juicing right away.
I've never tried juicing a sweet potato before. I didn't really know if I could expect it to squeeze a lot out.
I don't know what your yield is going to be. I don't know. But, you know, you could also juice it, treat the pulp with Pectinex and rejuice.
Either way, yield's going to be better than what you get chipping out of sweet potatoes and you toss them in an oven. And
can't be worse. Yeah. Anyway, give us a holler. Tell us how it worked. All righty. Thanks for calling. So we're going to break. We'll be right back with Cooking Issues. 718-497-2128. That's 718-497-2128.
You feel good? There's so much bone, brother. How you feel, man?
I feel all right.
I call your name. I don't want no people to know you're in here. How you feel, fella? Hey, yeah. Sure getting down. Look at him. Ha. We're gonna have a bunk.
Welcome back to Cooking Issues on the Heritage Radio Network, the show where we answer all of your cooking issues, or as Nastasha said today, just your issues. Call in all of your questions to 718-497-2128, 718-497-2128, here live in Brooklyn. Okay, so back to Thanksgiving for a minute, because I didn't get to finish what I was saying. So we got this, Patrick gave us this, gave me, I should say. Nastasha didn't get to eat any. Aww.
But I got my own.
Oh, you did?
Yeah.
Heritage breed?
Yeah.
But how was it?
It was great.
Did you overcook it?
A little bit?
Yes. A little bit or a lot bit?
A little bit.
Was there any moisture in it at all?
Yes, there was.
Was there a similarity with a hammer? Was it like a solid block?
No.
There was some juice left?
Yes.
Did you could eat it without gravy?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. Anyway, so as I said last week, the one that we got, was a Narragansett bird. Clocked in around 15 pounds, I think, 15 pounds or so. So smaller than my normal, gigundous bird, but, because heritage breed. So I did the bionic turkey, boned it inside out without cutting the skin, made an aluminum skeleton for it, made aluminum leg bones that we cut holes into so they're like a sprinkler system, hooked it up to a circulator, piped hot oil through the ersatz leg bones to cook the legs from the inside out at the correct temperature. I set my circulator at 67.5 for a final temperature in the leg after it was pumped through all the aluminum, about 66, which is where I wanted it. Then after about an hour and 20 minutes of that, dropped the whole bird, still with the leg pumping through to get it inside a lot, threw it into a big thing of duck fat. When I say oil, I meant duck fat. In duck fat, cooked it all to about 60. I started it a little higher at like 66 and dropped it to 65, and then finally a 64 for the finish off of the cook. So 64.5. Cooled it down in the fat like it was in the fat like it was a confit. Ripped it out, and because my parents, well, my stepfather actually, is petrified of any sort of cooking operation and doesn't understand it, I decided I was going to finish the bird in the oven rather than my preferred technique, which is first deep fat frying and then, failing that, ladling hot fat over it to crisp up the skin. So I'm like, all right, listen, my stepfather's name is Gerard, so I'm just going to call him Gerard from here on. One time I fried a turkey, out on the lawn, right? And a little bit spilled over and hit a little bit of the grass. And he now claims that I started a major forest fire that day. And he says the grass is still dead there, which, first of all, let's say it was. Who cares? I mean, they got an acre of land, like a little patch of dead grass. Make it the turkey, you know, cooking spot, right? Anyway, not a big problem, but this is the kind of thing that totally flips him out because he does, like I say, even though he's got one of the best palates for wine that I've ever met, of anyone I've ever met, and like loves food, petrified and doesn't understand anything about cooking at all. Like, doesn't know the sharp end of a knife. You know what I'm saying? Anyway, so this year, and then a year after that, I was like, well, I won't kill your glass, So I fried it, basically against my wishes. My mom said, fry the turkey again. This is years ago. And I fried it on the patio, on the flagstone, and some oil hit the flagstone. And this was one of those sub-freezing Thanksgivings, up in New York. And he was out there, I don't know what the hell he thought he was doing, hosing down flagstone in below freezing weather because the water was just freezing up as he was trying to get the oil off. Anyway, he ended up, it ruined Thanksgiving for the second time. For turkey-related reasons. I mean, I've ruined Thanksgiving many times for other things, arguments and whatnot. But anyway, so this year I was like, it's going to be somewhat normal. I'm going to throw the bird in the oven. Everything's going to be fine. I decide my mom has this baking sheet, almost like a Rumertoff, but it's made by, it's clay baking sheet. I'm like, oh, I'm going to throw this in like a pizza stone. I'm going to throw this thing in the, because it's got sides, right? So it'll catch the drippings. I'm going to throw it in the oven. I'm going to crank the oven to 500 degrees. And then I'm going to put the turkey in and the bottom's going to get brown just like the top because that's what, the bottom never gets brown properly when you're doing this kind of thing. And my mom's like, no, you're gonna set off the smoke detector. I'm like, Mom, she just got a new one put in. I'm like, first of all, here's a note to everyone out there. Like, I know safe smoke detectors, safety, all that crap. Like, put a dang some sort of switch. They are cooking detectors. These things are cooking detectors. And my mom's cooking detector is hooked directly to the fire department. So as soon as you start cooking, like, the engines come. And then in Westchester, where my parents live, they charge you. The city gives you a big fat bill if they show up at your house and there's no fire.
Really?
Yeah. So it almost makes you want to light a fire, like, whenever they come. You know what I mean? I didn't say that. I didn't recommend that. Anywho. So, like, I'm running around the house, like, it's like sticking these, like, plastic covers, these defeaters over the over the cooking detectors. And here's what's demented, right? They don't want to put a switch on it in case you should turn it off and then go to bed. But instead, they give you a plastic thing to defeat it that you have to remember to get on a chair and remove the plastic thing. Does this make any dang sense? It should be like your virus protection when you get on the computer where you say, okay, I will turn it off for the next 20 minutes. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Something like that. Anyway, I hate those damn things. My wife installed one once in my apartment in New York, even though we're in a fireproof building. And my only memory of it is it going off and me getting so angry that I literally jumped up and one hand punch fisted it. Street Fighter move. Like, punched and like rained down on the floor in like little pieces. And I was like, I'm sorry. I had to apologize to everyone. I was like, sorry for the outburst, but I have this like visceral reaction against cooking detectors. Anyway. Anyway, whatever. Here's the thing also, when you're cooking in the kitchen, right, you know if there's a fire. It's not like in your bedroom or in a hallway at night. You know when you catch something on fire in the kitchen, right? Anyway, and plus, everyone's house is underventilated, so there's always smoke whenever you're doing any sort of good cooking operation. So either everyone in the world is setting
up... apartments in New York.
And houses have those crappy little, like, Home Depot, Brone, nothing against the Brone Corporation, like vents, and you fire them up, and they never can get all of the smoke out. So either everyone is cooking poorly, maybe true, or everyone is enduring smoke, more probably true, and then a good portion of those people, like, someone in the house is freaking out about the smoke, right? It's irritating. The whole thing's irritating. Anyway, whatever. So I'm like, it's going to be fine. We put the little defeaters over the cooking detectors, fired up the oven to 500, which is the highest that thing would go, convection, threw in the baking sheet, got it all nice and hot, throw the turkey on, and for once the turkey actually fit in the oven because I didn't bring a 30-pound turkey with me, or, I brought, like, a 15-pound turkey. put it on. All of a sudden, smoke all through the freaking house. Smoke everywhere. Smoke on top of smoke on top of smoke. And I'm like, you know, whatever. It's smoke. I don't care. Everyone's flipping out. Open it up. The dang baking sheet, the clay baking sheet, had shattered in two. And all of the drippings and fat and everything from the turkey that was crisping up in the thing were on the bottom of the oven, basically smoking like the devil. And so I didn't get to fully brown the turkey. And yet still the most delicious bird I've ever made in my life once we got through the whole, you know, ruining Thanksgiving aspect of it. So to report back on the Narragansett turkey, do not overcook the turkey, but the bird definitely had, like, it was like turkey squared. It tasted like turkey with turkey flavor in it, even though I hadn't reinforced it with anything. It didn't put gravy on it. I brined it lightly before we cooked it, but, you know, no big deal. But it had a very meaty flavor, enjoyed by all, including my stepfather's 90 or 91-year-old ex-butcher father, who spent his years, butchering animals back in the old days, back when meat had real flavor. So that's my report back on the Narragansett turkey, and don't try to crisp that thing on top of a clay baking sheet, because bad things will happen. Anyway, do you want to catch back up on time and take our second break now?
Sure. All right, you want to talk about the class?
Oh, yeah. Okay, before we go to break, I have a class coming up, and again, you know, apparently if you listen to the first segment, not so good at the self-promotion, but this is actually a very inexpensive class. If you happen to be in New York City tomorrow and you want to learn how to make some holiday cocktails that you can make at home and some that require liquid nitrogen and rotary evaporation, then for the meager price of $125, and you'll get, how many drinks are you making? Some preposterous number of drinks?
Four.
Hell, it's cheaper than a bar almost, because we're going to give you snacks and everything too.
That's true.
When you think about it, it's 2 hours, 6:30 p.m. to 8:30 p.m. I'll be there. Nils Norn will be there. And we're going to, you know, make some drinks that go on fire. We're going to make some drinks that are cold. We're going to, anyway, it's tomorrow. And you can sign up by going to www.frenchculinary.com or something.
Yeah.
I don't really know. I should know this kind of stuff.
No, you have to go to the International Culinary Center from the French Culinary.
Oh, well, I don't know.
Just
don't know.
Google Dave and Nils holiday cocktails.
Anyway, it should be fun. And if nothing else, you will have a lot to drink. So, check that out. Call in your questions. We're coming back for another segment at 718-497-2128. 718-497-2128. Cooking Issues.
How you feel, brother?
Feeling good.
You feel good?
Feeling good.
Ain't so much bone, brother. How you feel, man?
I feel all right.
I call your name. I don't want no people to know you're in here.
Yeah.
How you feel, fella?
Right.
Hey, yeah. You're getting down. Look at him. Ha. We're gonna have a bunk.
Welcome back to Cooking Issues. Dave Arnold and Nastasha Lopez here in the studio, waiting for your call at 718-497-2128. That's 718-497-2128. Coming to you from Bushwick, Brooklyn. All right. I have some questions from the email. We haven't answered any email questions today, have we yet?
Uh-uh.
No? All right. I have a couple of questions, Chris S. says. I really want an ISI or EC, because they're switching. They're switching to EC here in the U.S., or they're switching to ISI?
EC, I thought.
EC? Yeah, they're both. Like in Europe, they're ISI, and here they're EC, or vice versa, or something like that. So they're both true. We're just going to say EC from now on. And you all know what I'm talking about, the whipped cream makers that we use for like either whipped cream or rapid infusion technique, you know, developed a couple months ago. So the question Chris has is, which is the best one of these EC things to buy. EC Whip. First of all, don't buy the, I mean, nothing against, but don't buy the seltzer one. It's the most limited. Make sure you get a cream one. And there's all different kinds. There's Profi Whip. There's the Gourmet Whip, like 9 million. They all have crazy names. But in general, the big deal, the newer ones have silicone grip rings on them so that you can grip them when you're wet as opposed to the older ones. So I'd look for the ones that have the silicone grip ring. I should know like exactly what all the line models are, but I don't. The only big difference, really, is a Thermo Whip. The Thermo Whip is looks like it's like a 3/4 of a liter or something, but it's actually smaller. It's a 1/2 liter, and it's insulated. And with the Thermo Whip is very useful for people who are working on a line or in an area where they need to keep something hot or cold, and they don't have access to either keeping it in the fridge or in a bain-marie of hot water for service, right? So if you need to keep something hot or cold for a long time, then get a Thermo Whip. But they're a lot more money, and their capacity is lower. Now, I would definitely, I mean, you're more limited if you get a smaller size, but it's also going to cost you less to do a recipe in a smaller size than in a bigger size, because you can't just, when you're doing an infusion in an EC bottle, you know the amount of product in it and how many chargers you put in it are variables, and so you want to keep your recipes the same all the time. Most of my recipes are written for 1/2 liter containers, you know, but you can scale them up to liter containers. If you can only buy one and you know you're going to need to make a lot of product at one point, maybe you have to get the liter size, but it's an interesting question to answer. I use mainly 1/2 liters. By the way, for any of you, like, we're like literally in a construction zone here, so if you hear any like hammering, like, don't say that it's not Jack's fault. Our engineer, he's not like doing construction, but there's only so much sound insulation that we can do, and so there's like, you know, it's because they're making Roberta's Pizzeria here even better than it was before. That's why, and so it's worth it. Second question Chris has is, if you put pineapple in an EC with alcohol and charged it, would you get both flavored alcohol and alcohol-infused fruit, similar to using a vacuum machine? I have tried it. We've done it. And yes, you do get some infusion into the pineapple itself. I don't know that it's I have to redo it again. It works. I don't think it's maybe as effective at getting the stuff into the pineapple as the vacuum machine, but it's pretty close. Like, it does actually work. And in fact, I'll probably be demoing that tomorrow. Yeah. The caveat is you want to make sure that you use nitrous so that the pineapple doesn't taste carbonated. And I think you're going to boil more of the liquor out when it bubbles out than you would using a vacuum. So I think the vacuum gets a stronger infusion into the pineapple. Pineapple is also interesting because a lot of its aroma, once it's extracted, is very fleeting, especially in distillations and things like that. So you're going to want to probably, you know, balance. Like, I wouldn't keep pineapple for a long, long time, even though people do. I think it, like, loses some of its good aroma. But I hope this... hope that helps. Okay, Teddy DeVico wrote in. He said, what are your thoughts on getting the sous vide supreme? Is it as accurate as an immersion circulator? Thanks. No. No, it is not. The sous vide supreme, another little gripe you've heard me say before, sous vide is cooking in a vacuum environment, in a vacuum bag, and sealed, like using a vacuum machine. Sous vide supreme has nothing to do with sous vide. Sous vide supreme is a low temperature cooker that's basically a non-stirred water bath. Non-stirred water baths have limits of accuracy because they're not stirred, right? I'm not saying it's a bad piece of equipment, but I'm saying that there are limits to its fundamental accuracy, and over very long periods of time, it probably gets a fairly accurate result if you don't stir and you leave it. I mean, if you just leave it sit, it'll probably equalize over a long period of time. But in general cooking, I would say that it's not going to be nearly as even or accurate as an immersion circulator, which is typically good to a couple tenths of a degree across the entire bath. So also, immersion circulators are a lot, they can do various different sizes, and they take up less space in the kitchen. The sous vide supreme, I realize, is a couple $100 less than a circulator, but if I was going to get one, I would save up the couple hundred extra dollars and get an immersion circulator. I would personally, and I shouldn't ever say this, I would rather have like my own like DIY, like, you know, home ghetto circulator than the sous vide supreme. But that's me. That's me. Don't take this. I'm sorry. I apologize. It's not a bad product. I'm just saying that I'm very pro-circulation. Another thing you might want to do is put an aquarium pump into a sous vide supreme and have it circulate, and then I think you'd get rid of all of its shortcomings. That's another solution. That's like a $25 solution to the problem. Oh, we have a caller. Caller, you are on the air.
Hey, Dave. It's Rusty Shackelford. How are you?
Hey, doing all right.
I'm glad to hear that. I got a question for you. I'm illegally distilling alcohol.
Good.
Yeah, I... You know, when I originally was directed to cookingissues.com, I found a kindred spirit in you. So What I want to know is I want to do a Dr. Pepper infusion because, as we all know, Dr. Pepper is the champagne of beverages.
Yeah. It's not, yeah, champagne. We got to think of another one. I have champagne for my favorite beers. We got to call it, we need like some sort of sham soda term. Yeah, Dr. Pepper, good product. Okay.
Dr. Pepper is the preferred drink of the booth at Heritage Radio Network as well.
Wow.
See that? I can hear that.
Yeah. So, okay, so what do you want to infuse with Dr. Pepper?
I just make a basically a neutral grain spirit. That's all I distill right now.
Right.
And it comes in around like 45-50%. And I wanted to just, I bought an ISI and I want to infuse Dr. Pepper flavors into booze.
Mm. Well, okay. Well, I mean, the problem is like a liquid, like, you know what you should do is just buy Dr. Pepper syrup.
Mm.
Yeah, you should, like you should just, like, I don't know whether you can, like, Dr. Pepper, is that Coke or Pepsi?
I think it's actually it's not owned by either of them. It's like a Nestle or something.
Right, but they always go through a, you know, in other words, like, even if you're an independent locally, you either go through a Coke distributor or a Pepsi distributor for your bottling. So, anyway, my point is, if it's ever on tap anywhere, which it is, right?
Yeah.
It means you can buy the syrup in a bag-in-box situation. Mm-hmm. And so those syrups are typically very high Brix because they're mixed in low quantity so that you can get many, many, many gallons out of it. And then mm-hmm. you could just do the real deal. You know what I mean? So you're talking adding, you know, like a very small percentage of product. So you could still – you could make a straight-up Dr. Pepper, you know, booze and not take it, you know, below 40%. If you're starting with 50, you could take it not below 40 and have just straight up Dr. Pepper liquor.
Mm.
You know, and then carbonate it.
Would it be possible to spin the Dr. Pepper syrup through a centrifuge to, like, clarify it, or no, that wouldn't work?
Well, okay, so it's an interesting question. So clarification, right? Typically, clarifying is just going to get rid of stuff that makes it light not pass through it.
Yeah.
Dr. Pepper, the only reason light doesn't pass through it is because it's so concentrated. Like, everything mm-hmm. is actually in solution there. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah,
so,
yeah.
If you want it clear, right, then you'd have to, I mean, the problem is that like the sugars wouldn't come through and like some of the bittering agents wouldn't come through. So if you redistill Dr. Pepper, all you get is kind of the aroma. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Which isn't necessarily what you want. Another thing we could do, I don't really know the recipe, although I know it has prunes in it, which is why like the fake ones are called like Dr. Thunder.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? You know, reference to your butt, I guess. But I don't know the actual recipe of Dr. Pepper, but I'm sure this is something that is like a known like thing on the internets that we could look it up. And then if we figure out what the flavor profile is, well, then you could start doing distillations with the aroma components of it and then mm-hmm. try to mimic like the sugar acid balance of something like, for instance, in the prune and get it to come across. And then you could use something that's like less color. Also, there are white prunes, right? So if you're going to use a prune, like most prunes are purple because most plums that are made into prunes are purple. But there are white plums that are made into prunes. You can't get them commercially. I think there's some French ones. It was stretching my memory a lot, but I believe like Brignol prunes can be white. I'm not sure. But anyway, so you can get that kind of dried fruit flavor, and you could add some kind of plum essence back to it to get a plummy thing in a clearer liquid if you start from first principles. But then you're going down a much longer road rather than if you just want like straight up fast delicious, you get yourself some liquor and you get yourself some Dr. Pepper syrup and, you know, you water it to whatever level you want to drink it at and then carbonate it and then you're good to go. I mean, that's like a one day problem. Do you know what I mean?
I will send you a bottle once it's all made.
We appreciate it. Thanks for calling in.
One other question.
All right.
I want to know what your favorite Simpsons episode was.
What?
Wow, you know, I haven't watched The Simpsons in a – I appreciate the first non-cooking question. I haven't watched The Simpsons in a long time because, I used to watch it faithfully, and there are so many good ones to choose from. The one where the pig is flying through the air and Homer says it's still good, it's still good, it's still good comes to mind.
At least for the vegetarian.
Yeah, that's a good one. When Krusty went to jail the first time around, that was an amazing, amazing episode. Like – the itchy and scratchy censorship one, the flag burning one. I mean, there's so many. It's so hard to choose.
Think about it for a while. I'll listen next week. And
all right, I'll put some good thinking into that one.
All right, Dave. Thanks a lot.
All right, thanks for calling. All right, So we see if we can rip through some more questions before we're done?
Sure.
Jack, we have a couple minutes here. Can I rip through some of these questions?
And Jack, you've never given me a Dr. Pepper in the studio.
Wow, she's calling you out. Calling you out. Also, Dr. Pepper, for those of you that are diet drinkers, a good diet flavor. Look, you know what? Nastasha's sitting here crinkling up her nose. Look, people who drink diet sodas, right? And I grew up drinking. I realize everyone's going to hate me now. Oh, I got to drink diet soda. Listen, it's like people who drink diet sodas, right? We don't drink just one. Like people who like have sugarful sodas are like, I need a little bit of a boost. You know what I mean? People who drink diet sodas, they don't drink water, right? All they drink is diet soda. So they need to pound a bunch of these things to stay hydrated, right? That used to be me. Now I drink exclusively seltzer, right? So I don't drink really soda that much anymore because I drink exclusively seltzer. But realize that your diet soda drinking friends and neighbors are using it as a hydration technique, not as a, like, I need a little bit of sugar. So, you know, and if you're buying for a party, right, never let a sugar soda drinker buy soda for a party. They're always wrong. This is why, at the end of the night, there's no Diet Coke left, and there's 8,000 bottles of Coke left at the end of the party.
No
why?
Way.
Yes, you have no idea what you're talking about. Look, a diet soda drinker goes over and locates their 2-liter bottle, right? And then they drink it, right? Whereas you have, like, a cup of Coke. Like, mark my words. Let diet soda drinkers buy the non-alcoholic products for your party. All right, hold on a sec. I got a question from Jacob. And he had a question about a tabletop vacuum sealer. Jacob, I'm gonna answer this question next week because I didn't have time to research the one that you put onto the emails. So I'll try and research that. A lot of people are interested in lower priced vacuum machines because kind of the entry level price for a real vacuum machine is in and around $1,500. And there's a wealth of new ones out there that are $300 and $400. And the question is, are they any dang good? The answer is, I have no idea because I haven't used them, but I'd like to look at the specs and see whether they're any good. It would be great. Like, my life would be really cool if, like, I had the money to go buy all this equipment and test it for you guys. I don't. You know what I mean? I don't have access to it because one thing I'm good at, Nastasha, right, is putting equipment through its paces.
Right.
Yes or no?
Yes.
Yes. Okay. And one last question also from Teddy DeVico is... He recently got a Twist and Sparkle, which is a new carbonation unit from EC that carbonates liquid. And he says it's used in drinks, but why not savory things such as sauces or broths? Have you carbonated any sauces or broths or other savory liquids? Yes, but you know the issues are, one, the sauce has to be good served cold because when you heat it, you're going to lose a lot of the carbonation. And it has to taste good carbonated, which means it has to taste good with CO2. A lot of times with savory dishes, when things have CO2 in them, they start tasting like they're a little bit fermented. And so you have to watch out for that. I would do a quick test just by, you know, like doing 50-50 with, if you have the Iodized Twist and Sparkle, just try it. The rules are, make sure it's cold, make sure it doesn't have, if it has any like milk in it, you're done. It's going to foam over and spray all over your house. If you have particles in it, then it's going to foam up and spray all over your house. So it needs to be clear, otherwise you're going to run into real problems. But other than that, the only rules are keep it cold and does it taste good? And that's basically like a general good rule for life, right?
Well,
for carbonating.
Mm, yeah.
Keep the temperature where it wants to be. What?
You said it's a good rule for life.
Good rule for life, yeah. Well, yes. I'm not going to get into it on the air. Anyway, so this then has been Cooking Issues. Come back, visit us next week, Tuesday, this time.
Vicious, vicious vodka. Oh, you did that. Got me on this corner, and I don't know where I'm at. Supposed to meet my baby.